From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on March 2, 2016, when Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that independent pharmacies across New York State would be able to provide naloxone to their customers without a prescription. Naloxone is known as Narcan, and it's designed to reverse an opioid overdose. You probably know by now that we are in the midst of an opioid epidemic. But here we are 16 months later, and it doesn't appear that a whole lot of people are taking advantage of the Narcan availability. For healthcare leaders, this is an important point to stress, and it is just the start of our discussion this hour. Maybe you saw the headline in the story in NPR yesterday, opioid prescriptions falling but remain too high, according to the CDC. So there's a lot to talk about this hour. I'll welcome my guests now. Dr. Mike Mendoza is Monroe County Health Commissioner. Dr. Mendoza, nice to have you back here.
Good to be back.
Jennifer Farringer is Director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence for the Rochester area. Jennifer, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And welcome to Dr. Holly Russell, who is an Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at URMC. She's part of a group that was just awarded a grant to expand Suboxone access in our community. Dr. Russell, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And given that hook, I just want to right off the bat make sure our listeners have some definitions described and sort of cleared up. A couple of our listeners this morning heard me tease this discussion, and they heard Narcan, Naloxone, Suboxone. A couple have asked, what's the difference between a Naloxone and Suboxone? Can we start there?
Sure, absolutely. So Naloxone is the generic name for what's in Narcan, actually. So that's what we use in an emergency setting, and that is only absorbed either through an IV or through the mucosa, so through the nose and the commonly available sprays. That's what we're trying to promote, what Dr. Mendoza is trying to promote. Suboxone is also a brand name. It's a combination of a medicine called buprenorphine and Naloxone. The only bioavailable part of that medicine, if you take it properly, is the buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is a partial agonist on the opioid receptors. So if you think of your typical medicines, this includes OxyContin, morphine, basically every other opioid you could think of, those are full agonists. So if you take more, you get more of a response. Because buprenorphine is only a partial agonist, there's a ceiling to the effect. This makes it considerably safer so that you can take more, but you don't get the respiratory depression, and it's nearly impossible to overdose on buprenorphine. So it's a medicine that we use in this medication-assisted therapy that you hear about, MAT, and it helps, there's really great evidence that it helps keep people off the other opioids. It prevents cravings, it allows them to go about living their life, and it's pretty much a miracle for a lot of people.
All right, so listeners, I want to kind of set the stage for this hour because in some ways you may think, well, we've talked about opioids recently, but I want to stress a couple of things. Number one, I want to talk about what the CDC says about what we know about prescriptions. They are falling, but still not falling enough. And in some ways, I want to trace the roots of how we got here. Dr. Russell sent me a PowerPoint that you did pretty recently. When did you do that?
In the fall.
Just absolutely, for me, enlightening in ways that even all the research and all the work we've done for this program on this subject in recent years, it told the story of how we got here in a way that is cogent and really important. So we're going to be working through that. A lot of it, by the way, comes to how we deal with pain and how that approach really changed in the mid to late 90s. So we're going to talk about that. I also want to talk about the concerns about Narcan availability. Do enough of us know about this? Are we taking advantage? And if not, why not? And how do we change that? Often when we talk about opioids and heroin, we hear from listeners who have their own personal stories to share or family stories that they want to work through. You can do that this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. But let's start with 2 points. Dr. Mendoza reached out to me recently with, I thought I detected a little frustration that the Narcan access is there, but people aren't necessarily taking advantage of it. What's going on?
Well, it was surprising to me to find that basically anybody in the community can walk into any pharmacy in the county and pick up a supply of Narcan. And, in a lot of communities, they don't have that benefit. And you have to get a prescription from your clinician to go to the pharmacy and pick it up. But here in Monroe County, we don't have that barrier. And so I started
calling
around.
That's a good thing you said.
That's a very good thing.
That's a good thing.
Because we want people to have access to this life-saving way to reverse an overdose. A lot of communities don't have that. So I took it upon myself to call various pharmacies and just inquire, when was the last time you gave out Narcan? And many pharmacies said I've never given it up. I talked to the vice president at Wegmans, and they've only given out in the range of 30 to 35, and that's across, you know, the entire area. And so that made me wonder, well, you know, we've got the means to potentially prevent overdoses, and yet we're not taking advantage of this here in our community.
Is it just that people aren't aware that they can get it? Is that it?
I have to suspect that's part of it, for sure.
Okay. And so that's one of the reasons you're here. So speaking directly to our listenership, and again, I think we will probably hear from people this hour. We usually do, because this problem has become so prevalent. It's not limited to a part of Rochester or just the rural areas. This is really everywhere, and it hits all classes and backgrounds of people. What's the direct message you want them to hear first and foremost, Mike?
I want you to understand that Narcan is a life-saving medication. We can pick it up without a prescription. We can just go to the pharmacy and get a supply. And it's good for everybody to have, particularly if you're in a home with somebody who's taking an opioid medication. If you are somebody who's using drugs, to have that available. But really, it's a life-saving medication, and it's entirely safe. It's much safer than epinephrine, which we would use in an allergy situation, for example. Narcan is completely safe, and it's there's really no risk to having it around.
What does it look like?
It comes in several forms, but typically it comes in a little blue pouch with two syringes in it and a vial that you can put together, and it's very small, and you can keep it in your home, in your car, your backpack.
Okay, and doesn't have to be, I mean, it's pretty discreet, can be stored just about anywhere?
Just about anywhere.
Okay, doesn't have to be refrigerated, things like
no,
that.
No.
And, Jennifer, is this a case that you think, is it just a lack of awareness that this Narcan availability, especially in Monroe County, is out there now, or is it also a case where is there stigma associated with showing up and picking up Narcan? Is there a concern that people have about that?
I think in spite of the education that we're doing and reaching out, there still is a misunderstanding. So one, I so agree with Mike, you know, to get the message out that is 100% safe, you know, and I encourage groups, you know, if we were all sitting around the room, even the four of us, and we were to give everyone Narcan, unless you're on opioids, it's going to do absolutely nothing to you. So it's an absolute safe medication. We also promote the two community groups who do opioid overdose training. It's a very brief 20 to 25 minute strong recovery, Trillium or But2. So that's another way to access. But as Dr. Mendoza said, it's even easier. You can walk into a pharmacy. Now through the community groups, you'll be given a free kit and a 20-25 minute educational piece about what Narcan is, what it isn't, and the importance of carrying it.
Okay. And Dr. Russell, you gave us a good definitional primer when we started the hour. Can you also weigh in on your thoughts on Narcan and follow up on some of what you just heard there?
Yeah, absolutely. It's completely safe. It should be in the hands of everyone who knows anyone who's taking opioids, either by prescription or illicitly. And I think part of the reason that there's difficulty accessing it is the stigma associated with opioid use and addiction in general. And I think part of what Jennifer and her team are trying to do with reducing the stigma will increase the access to it, because people will be less afraid of asking for it.
People may also be wondering, you know, in a life-saving situation, how do you know you're at that point? Who administers? You know, when Narcan is used successfully, what is the typical scenario, Dr. Russell?
Well, you know, one of the effects that I had mentioned before about opioids is when you use a lot of them, the main side effect that leads to death is the respiratory depression, and the Narcan immediately reverses that. And people, as you mentioned, there's this fear of who can do it and what will happen. And what we're here to say today is you don't need to be afraid. It is incredibly safe. There's no danger of anything bad happening if you use it and someone is not overdosing. They can use it, and any time that the thought even crosses their head that they find somebody that's unconscious that might have been what happened, that they overdosed, it is completely safe to use Narcan in any situation where you even think that might have happened.
The only caution, or the thing that I try to impress upon people, the first thing you do is call 911 because you want to have the kit. So you need to have the kit absolutely safe. You need to be able to be comfortable enough to use it. But first step is call 911. Why? Because too much of the heroin that's on the street now is super potent. We're at a kind of a perfect storm where there's more heroin available on the street than ever before. It's cheaper and it's more potent. Plus, it's mixed with some of the synthetic opioids like fentanyl, carfentanil, and others. So perhaps the one dose that you have may not be enough to completely reverse. So you want to know the EMS is on the way because they'll have on board more Narcan. They'll transport that person to the hospital and they'll have more Narcan. So you want to be able to, and that might be the case with this individual if they've taken an extremely potent form of heroin, especially one that's laced with fentanyl or carfentanil.
Now here's the ignorance of the host here. So people who are being saved by Narcan are not taking it themselves. Is that correct? Or is that not correct?
The odds are you wouldn't be capable to give it to
yourself. That's what I thought. Okay.
Yourself.
So it's important to communicate with people around you.
Exactly.
Okay. And I'm going to steal right from one of the slides from the PowerPoint that Dr. Russell did when it comes, because Jennifer just mentioned how potent heroin is getting. One of the slides in this, I'm looking at right now, the increasing role of fentanyl in heroin deaths. Mm-hmm. So number one, let's just talk about heroin deaths from 2011 up until the start of 2015. 10 a year at the start of this decade, now close to 100, and that's and just climbing. A few years ago. It's got to be way above that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, probably we're on pace for a couple hundred more?
Mm-hmm. Over 150 in 2016, for sure.
Okay. And no fentanyl found, according to the Monroe County Medical Examiner's Office, 2011, 2012, 2013, fentanyl starts to show up in about about five cases. Mm-hmm. Now, in the most recent full data, 2014, 50 heroin deaths were heroin laced with fentanyl. That's more than half.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it went from not being a part of it at all.
Right.
And the short description that I have as a layperson is fentanyl is, when we talk about super potent, it's not just heroin. You may think you're buying pure heroin or whatever you think you're buying, but it's heroin cut with something else, and that something else is really, really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess epidemic, a fair word for this, Dr. Mendoza?
Very accurate.
Okay. So now you've got the picture of what our guests think about Narcan. You've heard about the stigma, the availability, especially in Monroe County. Don't need a prescription.
Nope.
And not a lot of people taking advantage of that. I want to talk now about the headline that I saw yesterday, and some of our listeners might have heard the story on NPR. Opioid prescriptions falling but remain too high. Before we get to too high now, let's go back in time about 20 years or so. Dr. Russell helped educate, I think, through this PowerPoint that you did, when it comes to what changed. What's the difference, you know, between 20, 25 years ago and today? How did we get here? And I'm looking at this remarkable set of data. I guess it goes back to the American Pain Society in 1995, calling pain the fifth vital sign. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yep, I remember that.
Was that a mistake?
No, was it a mistake? At the time, we did not think so. But I think looking back, I think we can say it was a mistake.
And who was eager to help with that? Well, the pharmaceutical industry. So here, I'm just going to read a few things, and I want Dr. Russell to jump in, and we'll go around the table. But think about how we view pain management. How many times have any of us been asked, in a hospital setting, rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? That was less common. Now, all of a sudden, that becomes more de rigueur. And in the early 2000s, there were double the number of sales reps for opioids. They were called pain management specialists. But what they were sales reps for for Big Pharma. And in 2001, the Joint Commission, according to Dr. Russell's slides there, and she's citing the Wall Street Journal on this one. In 2001, the Joint Commission issued new standards telling hospitals to regularly ask about pain and then make treating it a priority. And the Joint Commission published guidelines on pain management. Who sponsored those guidelines? Purdue Pharma. The Joint Commission organized a pain management educational program. It was funded by Purdue Pharma. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Russell, I guess we go back 20, 25 years, and then we see this evolution. Pharma benefited. How many mistakes? I mean, if we could go back in time, we would certainly change a lot of this, wouldn't we?
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of makes me nauseous to even think about how this all got started. I mean, it was clearly all about money for the pharmaceutical companies. They basically blatantly lied about the safety of the opioid medications. They hid facts that they knew to be true about the dangers of using opioids.
How addictive they were, for example.
Exactly. And they somehow convinced the Joint Commission to make this an actual requirement. So the reason you're asked so often is that it's a Joint Commission requirement. So I work in primary care. I actually cannot close a note that I have written unless it has a number on a pain scale for a patient.
It's got to have the number.
Yep.
And it's amazing because pain is so relative. I mean, talk to any woman who's gone through childbirth. The day after childbirth, your scale of 0 to 10 is very different than it was the day before.
Yeah.
But you, and so I don't know why an arbitrary system like that, but it's required, you say.
Yes, it's a Joint Commission requirement.
Do you wish you didn't have to do it?
Yeah. I mean, it also creates the expectation for patients that it should be zero, I think, mm-hmm. when you ask it that way, which leads to these very challenging conversations about expectations for pain control and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and maybe our listeners are thinking, well, that's how it is everywhere. Well, another thing Dr. Russell pointed out, Americans consume an estimated 80% of the global supply of prescription opioids. 80%. It's not exactly like this in other countries when it comes to pain management, description, prescription?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in the other countries, but from what I gather, they just don't have these kind of regulations about asking about pain control. And the expectations, I think, from patients are different in terms of that it should be zero versus, like, what can I live with?
Hmm. Dr. Mendoza, go ahead.
And if you look at the percent of people in the United States who report severe versus moderate versus minimal pain, those percentages have not changed at all in the last 10 years. So the number of people that report severe pain has remained largely unchanged in spite of all the opioid prescriptions that we've been writing.
What do you think, Jennifer?
Mm-hmm. We're trying to encourage both physicians and patients to have a different conversation. So you may need to check a box and put a number, but how about a more of a qualitative discussion? So Evan, how do you respond to pain? Is pain preventing you from doing what you love to do?
I am the softest person you know. I am mashed potatoes covered in
frosting.
I would
challenge people, if that conversation were to take place, I think the outcome would be markedly different. And you wouldn't have maybe that artificial expectation that your ideal is to get to, I mean, who's at zero level of pain? It's kind of a factor of life. It's how we've chosen to respond to it, the immediacy that we've chosen to respond, and the emphasis on always decreasing a number rather than a subject. And the qualitative kind of conversation also could lead you down the path of exploring other safer non-opioid responses. Like, you know, you've got chronic pain, so let's look at safer ways. Are you exploring acupuncture? Are you exploring therapeutic massage, physical therapy, a variety of ways to deal with pain on an ongoing chronic basis? A much safer way to go than opioids.
Yeah, Dr. Mendoza, I recall a recent conversation with a couple of friends of mine who are both doctors, and they are from Europe. And they said upon arriving in the United States, they were amazed at the emphasis on pain mm-hmm. and on how it wasn't just pain. I mean, I admit I'm sort of soft, but I also don't think that we are supposed to live without pain, or that if pain happens, that it's necessarily the worst thing, because sometimes you have to get through something. Now, chronic pain is different. I occasionally have back pain. But as an example, my doctor friends from Europe said, wow, the back surgery industry in this mm-hmm. country.
Yeah.
Physical therapy is what they do in Europe, particularly Western Europe.
Right.
That's the answer. Here, it's, and I'm probably speaking a little out of school here. I got to be careful. I don't want to start a whole other conversation, because we're going to talk about back therapies, physical therapy, surgery on a different program. But they were just simply remarking how fast it's like, well, you might need surgery. And they're going, wow, are you ready for it? And well, what if it hurts? Well, opioids.
Right.
And they said, it's amazing how that cascade mm-hmm. happens.
Yeah, it is remarkable how it's really evolved here in the United States in ways that it has not been across the global community. And I think, you know, while the source of the problem here in the States is complicated, I think it's fair to say that the industry contribution to it has been a major one. And you know, the fact that, you know, Jennifer brings up a good point. We need to think about pain in the context of a person's life and what they do and what they want to do and their expectations, and not looking at a number.
Listeners, again, I would love to hear from you on pain management opioids, prescriptions. Do you live with pain? You know, what I also don't want to do is frame it so that anybody thinks anybody on any opioid is a problem or a bad thing. I mean, I'm sure there are thresholds, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But 844-295-TALK, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So here we are now today with the CDC, a new report out just yesterday, offering, here's NPR saying, offering a bit of hope. Doctors are prescribing opioids less often, and the average dose they're giving patients has dropped, according to the CDC. However, the number of patients getting opioids is still too high, and doctors are giving their patients prescriptions that last longer, according to the report in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. And the CDC's acting director said the following, quote, "The bottom line is that too many people are still getting too much for too long, and that is driving our problem with drug overdoses and drug overdose deaths in the country." And an addiction specialist at Brandeis University, Andrew Kolodny, said, "We are in the midst of the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history, but we are still massively over-prescribing," end quote. Dr. Mendoza, any disagreement with those quotes?
No, not at all.
And so what do you do about that? I mean, who is the main culprit of that?
It's very complicated. You know, I think the fact that we're making some progress is very reassuring. And to know that we have a long way to go is just the reality of the situation. It's a very complicated situation to get ourselves out of. You know, as a physician taking care of patients with chronic pain, you know, this isn't the kind of thing that you can just solve overnight. You know, a lot of people, through whatever reason, are now struggling through addiction. And one of the areas that we're really trying to emphasize is that addiction is a chronic illness. It's not a choice that people make when they wake up one morning. And so if you look at addiction like any other chronic illness, you know, you've got to develop a relationship with that person, work with them over time, understand that sometimes you're going to have a relapse. And we've got to make sure that once, you know, if we've made some progress, we don't just, you know, rest on our laurels and say we're done. We have to keep working with that individual through whatever it is they're going through.
And Dr. Russell, I think maybe my question on, you know, who's the main culprit if we're still overprescribing is unfair given the history lesson you gave us, going back 20, 25 years, because certainly we can look at Big Pharma's role, but it has created a cultural issue, as you said. People expect to be told you're not going to have any pain. And if you tell patients you're going to have pain here, what do they often say?
Well, I mean, so it's multi-level, like you're mentioning. It's a cultural shift within medicine. So I trained at a time when pain as the fifth vital sign was the gospel. And so we learned to titrate up pain medicine and those kind of things. And patients also learned you should expect to have your pain be a zero from asking these things. And so we're having to have two cultural shifts. One with the patient's expectations, and two within the medical education community, to when we're teaching our new doctors and our new residents that these are the other ways to manage pain and these are safe prescribing practices. So I think that's part of this, the reason it's going to take some time in terms of that report you're mentioning is that to have these cultural shifts, it takes time.
Yeah. Jennifer, you want to weigh in on that too?
Yeah. And I want to pick up on something you said too, Evan, about, you know, we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. So certainly we all, if we've come out of surgery, for example, you better hope that you have an opioid. But the issue here is not so much the opioid, it's the intensity of the opioid. So the potency of the opioid and the length of time that it's been prescribed. So if we can revert back to a time for using that not as a first line of defense, and if it's prescribed, prescribe it as absolutely conservatively as possible, understanding and accepting the risks involved. I know even just recently, last year, the New York State Attorney General fined one of the pharmaceutical companies, Endo, which, by the way, has just agreed to take Opana off the market. But why? Mm-hmm. It was because their reps were still going out to physicians giving this misinformation about don't worry about or downplaying the addiction risk and upplaying the need to alleviate patients of all pain. You know, so that was as recent as last year, March.
Well, every phone line has now filled up. So what we're going to do is get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. And I want Dr. Mendoza, before we go to break, to remind our listeners, the main reason we're here is because he wanted a chance to let the community know what apparently a lot of people don't know, which is that, especially in Monroe County, What's the situation with Narcan, which is designed to reduce an overdose? Tell real briefly, what do you want people to know?
We've got a life-saving medication that we can have in our hands without a prescription, simply by going to a pharmacy and picking it up. And to have that in our home, in our car, in our bags, we could potentially save a life.
So you can get you can get Narcan without a prescription in Monroe County, and forget stigma. Just know that it can save lives. That's Dr. Mike Mendoza, Monroe County Health Commissioner. Jennifer Farringer is the director of DePaul's National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence in the Rochester area. Dr. Holly Russell is an assistant professor of family medicine at URMC, and she's part of a group that was awarded a grant to expand Suboxone access in our community. So what I want to do is get that only break, and we'll come right back to your phone calls. If you're on the line, hang in there, and we're coming to you next. Coming up in our second hour, a story of adoption and a question about how much information adoptees should have. How easy should it be for adoptees to gain access, for example, to a birth certificate? What kind of privacy should be in place? What kind of protections? What was the law originally intended to do, and what was it not intended to do? We're going to look at all of that as we talk adoption next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's get back to your phone calls now. Peter in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, Evan. I was earlier in my life had an enormous bout with pain from an autoimmune disease. It was basically immovable for about a year, and I was offered opioids and was asked about the pain all the time and all that sort of thing. And I made a decision that the opioids did not cure anything. They masked everything. And I wanted to know how much pain I was in to see if I was making progress towards recovery. And as a result of that thought, I was able to make peace with the pain in my own mind and have a normal life from a year after I had this onset. And I think that the major problems have been that it doesn't cure anything. It would be like some of the other four vital signs that would not cure anything but would mask it. And that makes no sense to me in terms of what the opiate problem has occurred. And I do have a son who is adopted, and because you're next hour, and he has fought addiction most of his adult life. So I've seen both sides of it, and I just believe that opiates have caused far more damage than they've ever done good.
Peter, thank you for the phone call. Dr. Russell, I'll start with you on this one. Are you hearing from more people who have Peter's disposition on this, that even when they're offered or sort of given a prescription for opioids, are they starting to push back? Are you hearing about that?
Yes. I think, again, that goes back to the cultural change. Yeah. So people are reading the news articles. They're hearing about this epidemic. The CDC came out with a big campaign last year about, you know, being on opioids for chronic pain should be sort of the last ditch thing. You should try everything else. So people are getting that message. And I think motivated patients like this can really find other ways and have a successful and productive life, which it sounds like has happened. And so definitely that cultural change is happening.
Okay, Jennifer?
I'd agree. I do these talks on opioids all over the county to a variety of groups. And I'm starting to hear from more and more groups conversations similar to what Peter just described. Even situations where, say, their son or daughters are having wisdom teeth removed and they want to be right in there and find out, okay, what is the dentist prescribing, and challenge if the dentist has prescribed an opioid, say, you know, he's fine just with ibuprofen, and kind of pushing back and taking the lesser, less risky route.
Okay. Dr. Mendoza?
Yeah, I agree. I think, people are starting to become more aware, and I want to underscore what Peter's gone through, and that's not to be taken lightly. That was a very hard decision to make. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people struggle through that. And, we're working to try to make those decisions for themselves. But it's not an easy thing.
All right, let me go back to your phone calls. And as I do, I'll read just a few tweets from Dave, who writes, Evan, please do not trivialize the fact that some patients have real pain that needs to be treated and their quality of life is severely impacted if the pain is left untreated. Yes, addiction is a problem, but it is not fair to dismiss real pain that people suffer from and leave it untreated. Dave, I agree, and I hope that point has been made. you know, we are trying to sort of strike that balance between maybe pushing back where things have gone too far in the last 20, 25 years, but not saying, as I think Jennifer said, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Some people certainly have those needs, and I respect that. I want to go to Mark in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, hi. I'm listening to your discussion, and I just want to add a little texture to what Gabe just said. I've been healthy most of my life, but as I get older now, I'm finding when my back goes, I'm immobilized, but I know I have Vicodin, which within 20 minutes, I can at least move and do something. I'm hearing the prescription data, but we're talking about a demographic that is aging in the last 20 years. Baby boomers are getting older, and I'm not hearing any type of discussion around that. The pain management goes with baby boomers. I mean, it's an important thing, and I'm not talking about abusing it. I'm just talking about as the population gets older, my friends and I, we know that this is helpful also. Thank you.
Mark, thank you. I mean, it's an interesting point to say as we live longer, as a population generally speaking, will we need more pain and more severe pain management overall? Maybe not to the level we're at right now or where we've gone in the last 20 years, but will we need more? Dr. Russell?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, and I'm glad people are bringing it up. There are absolutely patients for whom it is, you know, the only option in terms of safe pain control. There's a lot of folks who can't take ibuprofen or Tylenol for other reasons, and you're left with opioids to manage that degree of pain that they're in. So we're talking about safe prescribing habits. We're not talking about not prescribing at all. And I think that's a really important clarification, that there are ways of doing it that are safer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
I just add to the consideration, and I think this isn't talked about enough, but the alternative therapies that are out there that are more effective on a long-term basis for somebody with chronic pain. Will it work for everybody? No, but be open to exploring other ways to deal with pain on an ongoing basis, from reframing to some mindfulness meditation to massage therapy to acupuncture to physical therapy to chiropractic. There's so many different alternative therapies I think one with chronic pain should and could explore.
Okay, and Dr. Mendoza.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you know, the point to consider here is that while we look at the preponderance of opioids in the community, you know, when we look at, you know, managing chronic pain, it's got to be taken on an individual basis and trying to understand where the patient's coming from and the risks and the benefits of the choices that person's facing. But I think when you take a step back, you know, I think we can say pretty safely that the pendulum's gone a little too far the wrong way.
Yeah, I just want listeners to make sure we try to keep in mind that when we speak in the macro and say that too many people are being prescribed, the prescriptions are too long, and that this has gone too far. That is not a case-by-case condemnation of anyone who has a prescription and may really feel like they need it. So, but I know that it is sensitive for people. We're going to go to Carlo in Union Springs in a second. Let me start with Sean in Rochester next on the phones. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, hey, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Just had a quick question for your medical professionals that you have there. I listened to a talk not too long ago talking about the hopelessness that people are feeling in a very broad sense in our country, and how a lot of people are self-medicating with opioids, this hopelessness. So I wanted to ask the question if there was a community organization that your guests have seen, or maybe a method that some of our staples in the community, like churches, things like that, can be doing to try and alleviate that hopelessness that is there. And maybe they can speak to some of that that self-medicating as well in the midst of hopelessness. Yeah, that's my question.
All right, Sean, thank you very much. Thoughts on that around the table?
Well, Sean, you raised a complicated point there. You know, I think, you know, the idea of medicating, you know, one's fears or feelings of hopelessness, you know, I think are tough. And I think, you know, people live through challenging times and people live through all sorts of challenges in their lives and their families and whatnot. And you raise a really wonderful point, which is that it's so important to find community in whatever way you do, and not to turn to substances, be it medications or alcohol or drugs, or, you know, to cope your way through, you know, these kinds of challenges.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thoughts, Jennifer?
Yeah, in terms of recovery, too, and I don't know if the caller was speaking to that level. Certainly, I'd agree with Dr. Mendoza about the self-medicating. We kind of forget that some people aren't even at a normal feeling space, and they're not using to feel enjoyment, but simply to feel normal. That's one conversation. But for those folks that are in recovery, there are some good community resources, some sober communities now that are springing up in Rochester, Monroe County, one of them being Rock Recovery Fitness, that now has a location, 1035 Dewey, with a variety of activities. So their belief is it come together in a sober community to explore a variety of physical activities at every age level, every physical ability level. But it's really an opportunity to basically come together, celebrate sobriety, and enjoy doing things together.
All right, let's go down to Union Springs. Carlo on the line next. Go ahead, Carlo.
Hi, thank you. Just want to put a little point of fact. I have a bunch of recurring little problems. I'm 70 years old. I've been fairly active between construction work and bicycle riding and motor, you know, a bad elbow, a dislocated shoulder, a back, a foot, you know, you name it. None of it's major. But I have found, I was treated by one doctor who said nobody he sees wants physical therapy. They see ads for the pills, you know, it's a generic way to talk about it on TV. And he said it's sad because a guy with maybe who's 40 or so has average problems, minor problems. He said over a decade, they get worse and they get less active because they take the pills. And again, I'm not talking about people with major problems. I don't want to demonize those people or act like they're weak because everybody has their own threshold. And, I stretch, I've done yoga. Yoga is a physical therapy. Forget the sort of woo-woo of it. It's basically a way to get your mind into your body and kind of work on it. So I just wanted to say that he says that it is a fight against people who just want the easy way out. And they have the 20 minutes. They just don't want to do it. And for a little point of fact, I would like to throw out, there's approximately one pharmaceutical industry lobbyist for every two members of Congress. And another thing is that, from what I can tell, in insurance does not make it easy to get physical therapy or any of this other stuff. Maybe it'll get better. But right now, and I guess we can draw our own conclusions why, insurance is really, they favor the drug therapy. So I will take your answer off the word. I know off the phone, I know I threw a lot out. Thank you.
Yeah, Carla, thank you. Let's kind of work backwards there. And before, we're going to get to Ellen and Menden coming up, who's got her own story about opioids versus acupuncture and what she could get more easily. But is Carla making a valid point that insurance makes it easier to get opioids than physical therapy, for example?
Well, it's certainly easier to write a prescription and go to the pharmacy than it is to commit yourself to going to multiple visits to a physical therapist, not to mention all of the work that happens outside of a physical therapy appointment. So it is in many ways easier to take a pill. And Carla's right. There are many challenges to getting physical therapy, and we have a shortage of physical therapists in our community. So it's a complicated situation for a lot of people.
Carla, you're making me want to do yoga. I've got the flexibility of a crowbar. you say you're 70 years old, and it certainly is having an impact on you. Jennifer, that was sort of the point you were making earlier. As we get healthier longer, hopefully, I just used hopefully incorrectly. I hope that we, are open to those things because it's not going to work for everybody. Right. But you're saying, with more of an open mind, there may be a wider menu of options that don't just lead to opioids.
Mm-hmm. And the caller made a good point. Yoga isn't all that we think about. I love his comment. It's not all woo-woo.
But Carla, what's wrong with woo-woo, man? Come on.
I think of where I go because I'm a practitioner of yoga as well, and I think of all the different levels and all the different folks participating, from 20-year-olds to 80-year-olds and everything in between. Mm-hmm. Never too late to start. And you can really improve as long as you improve your level of flexibility. You'd be surprised what back pain disappears.
And Dr. Russell, you want to add to what conversation there?
As a person who's had to do a lot of physical therapy myself, I can attest that physical therapy is boring and tedious. So it is much easier to take a pill. But it works, you know, and we know it works, and we have lots of good evidence that it works. And this, similarly with yoga, I think yoga is less tedious. Mm-hmm. But it's a true statement that it can just be harder to do. It takes more time. And also, our health system does not favor it. It does cost more. You have to pay many insurances. You have to pay a copay every time you go to physical therapy, as opposed to once a month with getting a prescription.
Why do we do that?
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to make a point about the hopelessness issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
We talked about opioids. We've been talking about them a lot without really talking about the pharmacology of them. But there exist opioid receptors in our brain for the reason that there are natural opioids, and those are our endorphins, and those are the feel-good hormones. So when you take pharmaceutical opioids, you feel good. And so there is a part of it that they exist to establish habits for us, good habits, like when you exercise, you get endorphins, and that mm-hmm. creates a reward system where you want to do those things again. So you can see that it's sort of a setup for disaster mm-hmm. when we sort of fake the brain out and give it these synthetic opioids. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's an issue of hopelessness and depression and, you know, in our country that when you take these opioids, you feel good, and it's part of the reason they exist in our brain, but we're sort of faking out the system.
Hmm. Teal sends an email that says, I agree opioids are a huge problem, but demonizing them can make end-of-life care difficult when families are resisting using appropriate pain management because they don't want their dying loved one to become addicted. A fair consideration, Teal.
That's different.
I think... I assume our guests would say that is generally, as Jennifer, you're saying, mm-hmm. kind of different.
Very much so.
And also, again, no one wants to demonize anyone here.
No,
we all just want, you know, the best possible decisions. But Teal, thank you for adding that to the discussion.
Thank you.
I want to go down to Menden. This is Ellen. Go ahead, Ellen.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to give you my bill from when I was in a very bad accident 5 years ago, and I shattered my arm in 9 places. And had to have, you know, a reconstructive surgery. And first of all, the doctor was really reluctant to prescribe what I needed to control my pain. So what I was given, which was, I think, oxycodone, and they tried tramadol, was making me extremely ill. And it was another doctor friend who suggested that they try at least a small dose or maybe a couple under control once I left the hospital, and that actually worked, but my doctor was really reluctant to prescribe it. But I had a really good pain therapist who said, you know, you take it at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then maybe 2 days later you wait and you take it at 10 o'clock in the morning when your pain is intense, and then maybe 11 o'clock, so you were slowly weaning. But the other key here, and it's been touched on, which is what really helped me a lot, was physical therapy, acupuncture, and massage. And monthly bills for acupuncture, physical therapy, and massage were $1,640. Not wow. covered by insurance, because every visit was a $40 copay, except for massage, which insurance wouldn't cover at all. And so if we want to fight these opioid addictions, we've got to open up these other therapies to patients like me where you absolutely need it, and it absolutely helped. Sure. And I am sure that the acupuncture absolutely helped control my pain, but it wasn't covered by insurance.
Ellen, thank you for that. And before I let our guests respond, on that exact subject, Dave, who wrote in earlier on Twitter, follows up to say, any suggestion of alternative therapies should contain peer-reviewed references from reputable journals, or else, he says it, he used a choice phrase for it otherwise. But I will just say, the second show I ever did when I hosted this program was about homeopathy. I am an evidence guy, and certainly we need, we should rely on evidence, and if there's not evidence for alternative treatments, I necessarily wouldn't expect it to be covered by insurance. Ellen is saying for her, she thinks acupuncture certainly worked. I understand. I don't have all the the study in front of me. I don't have it at my fingertips. But certainly physical therapy, certainly massage and other treatments mm-hmm. that don't get covered, the bills that pile up, when they pile up that way, no wonder people are back on opioids mm-hmm. because we're talking about $1,000 yep. you know, versus you know, a small copay, and all of a sudden you've got opioids. Right. So, Dr. Mendoza, mm-hmm. what do you think?
It's true. And you know, I echo the point of you know, trying to favor evidence-based therapies whenever possible. And physical therapy is evidence-based. Yoga is evidence-based. Acupuncture is evidence-based. Mm-hmm. And there are so many other treatments out there, not to get into the homeopathy issue, but there are so many treatments out there for which there is evidence coming. Mm-hmm. And what we do know now is that the evidence against opioids for chronic pain is quite strong. And so when you look at the balance of evidence, you know, it's a tough choice, but things are really starting to favor non-opioid treatment for chronic pain.
And before I grab one more phone call, Dr. Russell mentioned earlier that when you go back to the 90s and this approach was taking root, the pharmaceutical companies kind of put a little smokescreen up about how many people get addicted early on. I mean, they mm-hmm. were telling people, I think, less than 1%, and mm-hmm. and the answer is certainly not that, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So there was clear information that was not being communicated at that time. And also, to add to Dr. Mendoza's point, there has never been good evidence to support the use of opioids in chronic pain.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls. Rosie, Rochester. Go ahead, Rosie.
Hi. I wanted to share what I see as a risk, a kind of a missed opportunity to prevent overdoses. And when you take into consideration, unfortunately, where many of the addicted kind of show up or end up, they end up in somewhat of a captive or conditional situation. If they're in jail, if they're in drug treatment court, if they're in a hospital setting after an overdose, if they're in a rehab, if they're in a halfway house, if they're in a sober community like recovery or emergency housing, in all these settings you see many of those who have gotten to the bottom rung of addiction. If those venues were equipped to educate and arm each of those individuals at that point, I know it requires resources, but this epidemic is requiring resources too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a situation in Albany where they're actually equipping all of the inmates who are coming out of jail by educating them and arming them with the naloxone kit. And all of those other settings that I mentioned, what do you think about having, I mean, it obviously it requires money, but I see that as a real opportunity to make a difference here. I'll hang up for your comment. Thank you.
All right, Rosie, thank you. Dr. Mendoza?
Well, Rosie, thank you for bringing that up. You know, at Monroe County, we have been working very hard to try to get the Narcan opportunity in as many places as possible. Just 2 months ago, we started as an opioid prevention and training center, and we've started to provide training to county employees who are going out into the communities working with people who are at risk for addiction. Just 2 weeks ago, with the help of County Executive Cheryl Donolfo, we arranged a Narcan training session for the Monroe County Legislature. We're looking at doing more training in the community for all first responders in non-traditional senses, so people who work in restaurants, people who work in construction sites, airports, you know, looking for all those opportunities. And you raise a really good point. The other point I want to make is that addiction is a crisis that does not afflict any one demographic. You know the settings that you mentioned certainly are at risk, but we're seeing people having overdoses in virtually every setting imaginable, and so this is an epidemic that really does not discriminate. It crosses every demographic boundary you can think of.
And Dr. Mendoza, as we get ready to wrap, can I just ask you, you know, do we have a target in mind in the same way that I remember when the American Academy of Pediatrics puts out a report about number of C-sections, and they think in this country there's too many. It doesn't mean there should be none, but they have ideas for how to, you know, reduce and maybe better targets in their mind. Is there a target for opioid prescription that we're aware of? Are we still way above that threshold? Are we getting closer? Are we moving in a better direction with it?
You know, I'm not aware of any threshold. I can say pretty safely that we're still way above, mm-hmm. and we need to decrease right now. And I think while we're decreasing, we're going to learn more about what that threshold might be. But I think we're, as a community, still a long way away from knowing what that is.
Do you think 5-10 years from now, we will see that trend continue, that at least fewer prescriptions, fewer length of prescriptions?
I hope it doesn't take that long. But yeah, I do think that over the next 5 years, 2 years, certainly by 10 years, we ought to be seeing a much different picture when it comes to opioid prescription.
Okay, Jennifer? Mm-hmm.
And Rosie brought up a good point, too. We just don't have enough resources. But some of the things that are happening that are exciting in the community to respond to some of the scenarios she talked about is, one, an open access clinic that should be going live toward the end of this month. So that would be for either the law enforcement individual that has someone in front of them, hasn't committed a felony, serious crime, but there's a place to refer them to get access. This person coming from an ED as well, you know, they've just been had a reversal, they're being let go, now what? You know, so a kind of an interim place to get them access, level of care, find a bed, get them to a treatment slot ASAP.
All right, so there's a lot happening. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about that as that rolls out as well, because this is a conversation that needs to keep happening in this community.
Agree.
And I just want to thank all of our guests for being here. That's Jennifer Farringer. Always great to see you. Thank you for being here. Dr. Mendoza, thank you. Thank you for your expertise on
this.
And Dr. Russell, great history lesson for us, and thank you for your expertise as well.
Thank you for having me.
For anyone struggling with this, again, let's just keep trying to whittle down that stigma and work together to keep moving forward with this. Short break, more connections next.